Amen. Well, tonight we come to the last of our lectures on who is Jesus. And our question then concerns that Jesus of Nazareth, who was the object of people's experience, James and John and Mary and others, of people's faith, and of the inquiry of those early centuries, and the object of the creedal formulas that we've studied in the last few weeks. That's the Jesus about whom we're asking, who is he? And he isn't, of course, simply the object of other people's relationships and inquiry. It's the same Jesus who is the subject himself of relationship with people like Thomas and the beloved disciple and Mary, his mother, and the thief on a cross, and who wept over a city like Jerusalem, who in his prayer called God Abba. That's the Jesus we're inquiring about. And at the end of our long inquiry, let me remind you that we spent three lectures right at the beginning just setting the scene for it, and then we had 18 lectures looking at the New Testament to try to see what those who knew him most closely said of him. And in the last 4 weeks, we've been examining the discussions and debates and insights and clarifications that came in those first 400 years after his death in the early church. And so our purpose tonight, looking back over that long journey that we've taken, is to ask the question, what must we say of Jesus if we want to be faithful to the data and interpretation of the New Testament and of the early church? What must we say of him to be consistent with what they said of him? Well, the first initial answer to that question is to say that Jesus of Nazareth is a man, an individual male member of the human species. In a way, that statement ought to be totally obvious, and one would even wonder why it needs to be said. Just quickly reminding you of the New Testament, just a couple of brief texts where we find, for example, in the early liturgical hymn that you find in Philippians chapter 2, verse 7, they speak of Jesus as being in his outward appearance, in his body, in his everything about him, man. When they speak of him in that hymn as in having every likeness to us. And they go further and say that the form, the way in which he was a man, was extraordinarily taking the part of the poor, living the life of a slave, and dying on the cross the death of a slave. His humanity, his flesh, his human existence is totally obvious to them. In a rather late work of the New Testament, the first letter to Timothy, chapter 2, verse 5, we have the author saying, there's only one God, and there's only one mediator between God and mankind, himself a man, Christ Jesus, who sacrificed himself as a ransom for us all. Himself a man, obviously. The letter to the Hebrews, chapter 4, verse 15, and the section following that in that beautiful letter, says, we have a high priest who's been tempted in every way that we are, though he is without sin. He too lives in the limitations of weakness. Although he was son, they go on to say, he learnt to obey through suffering, but then he was made perfect. And finally, though any other 100 texts would do as well, Acts of the Apostles, chapter 2, verse 22 and 32 reads, Peter in his sermons talks about Jesus the Nazarene was a man commended to you by God. And he goes on to say, this man you killed, God raised this man, Jesus, to life. So my first point is that the New Testament makes it absolutely abundantly obvious, and those people who knew Jesus closely were clearly clear about the fact that he's a man. But and we've noticed this, because of other statements that need to be said about Jesus, and which we will explore tonight, and also because of the prevailing philosophical environment in which people thought about Jesus once he was dead and not that obvious to people, the Gnostic and Platonic worlds, the extraordinary thing is that it is his humanity which was the first thing to be denied, and it's the aspect that was given least attention all through that 400 years that we've observed. And so we find in, for example, the first letter of John, writing already having to defend the truth of Jesus' humanity. He begins his letter by saying that his subject is something that, yes, has existed since the beginning, that we've heard, that we've seen with our own eyes, that we've watched and touched with our hands. And he goes on to say that the person who denies that Jesus is the Christ is a liar. And he tells people later in the letter to test the spirit by which they are living. And his criteria for a true Christian is that every spirit which acknowledges that Jesus, the Christ, has come in the flesh is from God. Clearly, there were those who were saying that he didn't come in the flesh. He wasn't really human. And then we saw in this last few lectures Ignatius of Antioch, Justin of Flavia Neapolis, the martyr, and right through now to last week the Council of Chalcedon, insisting against certain speculations that were rife that Jesus is a man. I think we need to make the same point again today, that whereas I suppose everyone gives lip service to Jesus as a man, we would all have a lot of memories of a Jesus presented to us who was so unlike us, and a Jesus who is preached while ignoring the actual historical reality of his human existence and the environment in which he lived and the data of his historical life. That Jesus too can be lifted away from us and made so unlike us that we cannot relate to him. And so we've needed to stress that Jesus is a man. Let me draw some of the implications out for you. He's not a half man, half God. Jesus is not a superman, if we're going to believe the New Testament and the early church creeds. He's not so unique that he's a species on his own, which is the way we might be tempted to think of him. No, he's a man, an individual of the human species. His body is a human body, with all that that implies, all the limitations that implies, including his dying and his suffering and his pain and his thirst and his hunger and his being tired. His psyche, the mind, heart, emotions, affections, interior life of this Jesus of Nazareth is a human psyche like ours. His, and I'd like to stress this because I don't think we have stressed it enough so far, his religious experience is a human religious experience. The beautiful way in which he called God Abba, that prayer was arising in a human heart from a human psyche with human understandings, and it was a human response to the mystery of God. The very intimate religious experience of Jesus was intimate. It was human. We don't have to look for anything in Jesus' life. Some of the early fathers of the church did, but the Council of Chalcedon puts an end to it. We don't have to look outside his humanity to explain Jesus' human actions and human decisions. They are explainable in terms, and they are revelatory of what it is to be a human being. If then this is true, then I'd like to develop a couple of points with you. If Jesus is human, one of us, then we then have to examine our assumptions about human nature. Last week, or it may have been the week before, we compared nature with person. We looked at human nature and the exercise of human freedom. We looked at other forms of existence, and we saw that in fact nature categorizes the limits within which a being exercises its functions and its existence. But the more you work your way up the chain of being, as it were, the more you come from the stone to the human, the less nature tells you about someone. The more freedom emerges, and the more a person makes him or herself what he or she is by decisions that are made for that person or by that person. And so when we speak of Jesus being human, having a human nature, we are placing him within the limits that belong to the human. But he surprises us. We might have thought those limits were too close. When we look at Jesus and see a human being do what Jesus did, we cannot explain that by reference to something outside his humanity. We have to see it as an authentic way of being a human being. And therefore it opens up incredible possibilities for us. Let us look firstly. We're told he did not sin. We might have thought, without contemplating Jesus, that sin was part of being a human being, an inevitable part of the human existence. Now, obviously, it's statistically normal. It's obviously something that we're used to. It's obviously something we've got perhaps too used to. Jesus alerts us to the fact that it's possible to be a human being, to be a man like us, and not sin, not be distracted into sin. It's an extraordinarily beautiful statement, but it says something about human nature. When we look at Jesus, secondly, we see the amazing freedom with which he lived, freedom from so many things, the mental and emotional and sinful pressures that cause most of us to stagger and stumble and find other ways into things. We look at Jesus and we find him walking on the water, rising above the chaos that was around him and remaining sinless, beautiful, loving, faithful in his life. He was free for love. He was free for people. He was free for the world. He was free for his Father. He was free for a mission of love. And people couldn't stop him doing that. It opens up for us, I believe, amazing possibilities for what a human being can be. And thirdly, the intimacy of his religious experience and response. And I'd like to stay with that for a little while. I mentioned it a moment ago, his Abba, his prayer to God. If that is a human prayer, and of course it is, if it's a human experience of religious intimacy, and of course it is, then it must say something about our prayer, about human prayer, about human response to the mystery. Jesus, then, as we are now, was faced with idolatry. We do not perceive God. God is not an object of human perception. Religious experience is a unique dimension of experience because it has no object that is perceived. It's the experience of being loved by the mystery, being drawn into the mystery that we call God or Elohim or Yahweh or whatever word, Allah, whatever word one puts on the mystery. That religious experience is so fragile, so intangible, so profound and yet so vulnerable that it can easily be deflected into wrong areas. It's easy for us to be caught in false images. It's easy for the religious response to be institutionalized or domesticated or in somehow controlled by human beings. that was all around Jesus. We see it in all the groups that we looked at when we looked at the New Testament. That idolatry that was around. He seemed, was able to be open to the living God, the true God, and the fruit of it is, we saw in his life. Now particularly, not so much then, one of the fruits of idolatry is atheism and agnosticism. The people who have seen things of value, people who are searching for the truth, eventually, please God, reject false gods and reject whatever is attached to those false gods. And in our world today, there's, a fairly rampant agnosticism and atheism. And it's not all because of this, but I feel confident that a lot of it is because it's a rejection of false gods. The problem with atheism and agnosticism is that having rejected false promises, false hopes, untrue ways of finding security or meaning in life, the agnostic person is left with the necessity to block the horizon off where he or she sees it, to be the center, the autonomous center of his or her world, to limit the possible to what is possible for me without the mystery, and to deny so much of the fragile but genuine human religious experience that we have. Jesus, in his world, as we watch him, kept believing in God, kept believing in the mystery, kept crying out to the Abba, kept refusing to be the center of his own world, kept relying on, depending on, listening to the mystery, and kept refusing to define his world by what he could see in the immediate environment of his own horizon. He kept his heart open to explore the possibilities that the mystery of a redeeming God meant to him. And that faith gave him a hope that went well beyond the destruction of Jerusalem or the zealots or the intransigence of the Pharisees or whatever. It gave him a hope for people, and the fruit of that hope was in people's lives and in the early Christian church community. And of course, it released in him a human love that came from this divine source of the mystery that he called Father in his prayer. Now this human, intimate, superbly beautiful religious experience of Jesus, let me say again to stress it, it didn't answer the dilemmas of Jesus' life. It didn't solve the problem of the temple. It didn't substitute for energy and love and life-giving and searching and prayer and tears and all the other parts of our human existence. It didn't lift Jesus, because he had this wonderful experience of God, it didn't lift him above the ambiguities that we all live in. It didn't guarantee success to his hopes and dreams and ambitions and mission. And we know the story of the cross. But what it did for him, and what he managed to share with some few who picked up the message and who dared to believe their own religious experience, it opened up a way to live in the horizon of our world, of his world. It opened up a way to live in love. It opened up meaning. It opened up freedom. It opened up the possibilities that we see in the life of Jesus. Human possibilities accepted and the challenge accepted by the heart of a man.